now I leave the floor open for further questions.
Final question. It is obviously with regard to the knowledge that I believe the West has gained about the weaknesses within the Islamic community and how to exploit them. There was on Sunday, there was a very interesting documentary on BBC that was basically called
When?
Last Sunday.
Last week.
It was a Quran and the Kalashnikov. It basically explains how America basically created, funded, and with the help of Saudi Arabia, trained ideologically, basically the Mujahideen of Afghanistan to fight as a proxy against Russia. He didn't talk much about what was happening at the same time on the other side, when they were funding the war of Iraq against Iran. Basically, my question is, knowing that the West knows how to exploit this Sunni-Shia divide, is there any basis that we can have to unite? This is, that I think, potentially the biggest threat to unity.
Unity of Shia-Sunni can be divided into stages. What I call individual, community, nations, and international state. At this stage, bearing in mind the depth of the problem, as far as I'm concerned, these three are not possible. Because of the ignorance that exists in both communities, lack of understanding of each other's point of view, and the constant bombardment in the past where they have created a genie from the other side. It does not allow free movement between communities, nations, and international scale. This, however, is possible, where each one of us, whether we are Sunnis or whether we are Shiites, whether we follow Hanafi school of thought or whether we follow Ja'fari school of thought, we can communicate with each other. And through communication, we will be able to understand each other's point of view and understand that between us, 99% of religious aspects are the same. The 1% are extremely minor issues that we can leave it to the specialist to deal with it, but on a general point of view, we have more in common than we have it with any other society. So on an individual basis, where we, not only on an academic basis, we actually go and socialize. We go to each other's houses, we go to each other's mosques, we go to each other's classes, we invite each other in inside, and we gradually learn from each other's point of view. And then, this is possible. Once we can achieve this, then it becomes the step forward towards enough individuals within the community, and then brings the community together. Once you have communities coming together, then it becomes forms nations. Until you get to this stage, you cannot attain this. But there is nothing to stop us from at least working on this level. And this is the responsibility of all of us. When we have individuals that do not understand each other's point of view, that these theological or jurisprudential differences exist, even within four schools of thought. Hanafi, Shafi'i, Hanbali, and Maliki. within these four schools of thought, there are more differences that exist between Ja'fari and one of these two. You only need to look at the book called Al-Fiqh al-Madahib al-Khamsa. Fiqh or jurisprudence according to the five schools of thought. And you will see every single question that Islamic, the Imamiyya school or Ja'fari school of thought is similar to one of these points of views. Once you start working together, this socialization and social etiquette becomes the catalyst for creation of the community. Community that understands you cannot, by shaking or waving a kind of magic wand, create a coherent and motivated community. If individuals are not there, then it has to be gradual, but we have to make a start. Once we can, then obviously it is possible to work on an international scale where we do not allow the West to abuse us and turn one against the other. At the moment, the Shia-Sunni case has become the easiest way of creating disharmony between Muslims. You only need to send a representative to the Afghanis and tell that on the other side of the mountain the Iranians are coming, and that's it. Or go even within Karachi in Pakistan, tell one mosque that the Shias are coming to kill you, and go and tell the Shias that the Sunnis are coming. That's all. That's as easy as that. And this because individually we are not communicating with each other, there is general ignorance about each other's point of view and where we stand, and we have created a genie from the other side, that they have become the untouchable. At the same time, we have to understand that confront injustice, no matter who that person is. If you see individuals within your community trying to destroy unity, which is, you have identified it to be the source, one of the things that if you were to implement it, you will get away from the problems. If you see people trying to create injustice and disunity between community, you have to work to destroy them and work together. And that works for both communities. If you see a scholar saying that the Shia is this, the Shia is that, or the Sunnis are this, the Sunnis are that, and that, stand up. On what justification do you say this? Don't we have قُلُوا لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ تُفْلِحُ. There are a number of traditions we have it within Sahih as well as within the Shia sources. Whoever says أَشْهَدُ أَنْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ أَشْهَدُ أَنَّ مُحَمَّدَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ is your brother in deen. Either you haven't heard the other party saying أَشْهَدُ أَنْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ أَشْهَدُ أَنَّ مُحَمَّدَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ, or you don't believe in this hadith. Well, this is the way. If we do not allow these people to have the platform, this is possible. And this can become the catalyst for other work.
Actually, the platforms are where, you know, the masses get all the information, you know, is from Maulanas. Now, if Maulana, I mean, being an educated man, the very first thing he should do, you know, is to stop these things, you know. Like in Pakistan, a Maulana goes on the mumbar and he starts abusing, and similarly the other side, you know. It's not the individual side, it's the priest or Maulana, you see. The mostly, I mean, you know, what I have seen, you know, it's created by the Maulana.
You see, I disagree with the point. Why? Because of this division. The Maulanas that come to the community of Indian and Pakistan subcontinent are invited by your community members, not by themselves. You are the one who invite these Maulanas in. Who pays for the Maulana? Who selects them?
The committee.
The committee. Yes. So the form does not lie. There is an expression, I mean no disrespect to any Maulana. You pay peanuts, you get monkeys. If you are in search of being working on the profit and loss account, you want to get the cheapest one around, that you don't have to sacrifice any of your wealth for it. So what do you get? Second, third rate Maulanas that do nothing else but somehow motivate dogma. The fourth lies in the committees That is the Pakistani and the Indian subcontinent. That causes are included within it. It's the committee that makes a decision to go and bring the Maulana from somewhere else. Am I right or not?
True.
Hang on, sister, let me finish. There are a number of Khoja brothers as well as Pakistani brothers here that they know it. And I have worked with a number of them. The committee is making a decision that they want to bring the Maulana. The job description doesn't exist. They have no kind of criteria that this is the requirement of our Maulanas, that he has to fulfill these conditions. One person will go somewhere else, identify the particular place, whether it's India, Kenya, Africa, somewhere else, and pitch the Maulana to come and serve the community. And then when the Maulana, because of the decision and the criteria that have been laid down by the committee, which reflects the mentality of the community, if the Maulana comes and motivates dogma, they say it's the fault of Maulana.
But the majority of them
say, well, let's get one at a time.
Yeah, no.
So you agree this is the problem?
Yeah, I do.
So before we go to Maulanas, select individuals that they make a right choice when it comes to decision. When you could select individuals to represent you, that they are inherently dogmatic. How many centres do you want to mention within London and few miles around London?
Do they have access to these people? Do they know about enlightened Maulanas?
Yes, they have. They know it. London, you have at least three or four centres. Stanmore, Haydari in the south, Mahfilani, and one of the two places. And then just move a little bit outside London. Peterborough. That's another classical example. That if you come in the city, in the center, and you say something that they don't like, you will never ever put your foot again into that center. You become barred permanently. Why? Because you have said something that does not fit with the criteria that they have accepted it to be facts. So this is a problem. I totally agree, like any institution, there are individuals, these institutions, they give out or somehow bring out individuals that are incapable of leadership, incapable of delivering, incapable of guidance. But there are individuals that are capable of guidance within that institution. Who goes and selects these people? The incapable one and leaves the capable one behind. That's as far as the Pakistani and Indian subcontinent. When it comes to others, say the Iranians, the Arabs, and some other communities, and that, the same thing. There are centers that are established by individuals. Somebody is given a responsibility by the grand scholar and supported financially to go and establish a center and organize a community and motivate the community to get together. The question is valid here. If the person becomes dogmatic and somehow markets these kind of differences between communities, but not all of them do. So it's making a kind of sweeping statement that the problem all lies within scholars. They have to be blamed, I totally agree. But they are not the one all the time. In most cases, it's the others. In some cases, they are the one. Sister. Let me give you an example that supports again this view.
Didn't hear that.
She says she wants to confirm this kind of arrangement with regard to the selection of Maulanas. Few years ago, I used to live close by Idar al-Jafariya, which is a center south London. The night before, I think the night of the 9th of Muharram, I came out of the house to go to get catch a bus and go somewhere to a center. Because I don't speak Urdu, so I couldn't go to the Idar al-Jafariya. I saw a few ladies going into the Idar al-Jafariya with saris, the typical Indian kind of dress, but all bare bellies and this kind of... I couldn't understand that these people were actually going into a Shia Islamic center. There was a home next door that was a council property. Normally they let it for people to organize functions within it. Immediately came to my mind that these are Hindu people, that they are going, they have mistaken the Islamic center with the home next door. I stood there for a few minutes, nobody came out. Okay, let's go. The next night, the night of the 10th, night of Ashura. Again, I stood outside, this time, more of them. The same kind of passion went in. I couldn't hold back. I went and I asked the guy who was secretary to the mosque. I said, what's going on with these sisters coming in? He said, oh, don't talk to me, go and talk to Mawlana. After the meeting, I asked Mawlana, he said, look, when they came to pick me from Kenya and bring me here, they made a condition that I would not speak on three issues. First, as you guessed it, hijab, code of dress. Second, selling of alcohol. Third, selling of haram meat. As long as you don't talk about these issues, you can talk about anything else. Why? Because major contribution had taken place from individuals that were selling alcohol and then paying contribution to the mosque for Ashura. Contribution from people who were selling haram meat and then making contribution to the Islamic center for Ashura. This is why we can't get anything. Why? Because we do not have faith. Who goes out to put condition on the scholar, on the Mawlana, that you can talk on certain things and you can't talk on something else? Is the representative of the committee. Let us be honest about ourselves and criticize ourselves when there are faults within us. Don't put the blame on somebody else.
Why do you accept it?
That's the problem that I said. There are scholars that they have nothing else to do. This becomes their source of income. Yeah, I mean, they are not part of a marja'iyya. There is no control from marja'iyya on every single scholar that you go.
I don't know, all of them marja'iyya have some problem.
No, they don't. They not all of them. Why? I asked the person, I said, when they came to choose or select you, were there other individuals around? Yes. Who were they? They gave me names. Why didn't they select these? First of all, these people were not prepared to submit to the conditions. Secondly, they were more expensive than I was.
Who's training these people?
There is no training as such. Again, you're trying to wriggle out of it and put the blame back on Mawlana's and the institution that trained them. Put the blame first and foremost on the institution that goes and looks for the cheapest one around.
We're ignorant.
After so many years.
Why we call Mawlana? To teach us.
Yeah, exactly.
Teach you what?
Teach Islam. What do I call Mawlana? Why I came here?
Hang on, sisters. I used to think that people wanted to be taught. Until I actually frequented a couple of the Khoja centers. And Pakistani centers as well.
All centers.
Let us.
I know many people.
Yes. And a few other even Iranians.
Oh, they are the worst
ones. They are the worst ones. And I suddenly came across conditions being put indirectly that you cannot talk about these kinds of things. We work in a structure. And anybody who talks against this structure, we don't like it, Mawlana, please don't talk. Initially nicely, please don't talk about this. Then the threat comes in. So it's not the Mawlana's fault all the time. While I agree, in some cases, in any society, I mean, you replace this piece of cloth with a designer suit from Chanel. And with a tie as well, the dress itself is not going to make a difference, make a character out of somebody. It depends on the character itself. Whether that character is wearing a jubba and amama is not going to make a difference. There are individuals that are weak in character. And there are individuals that are strong in character, in any society. within students, within the teachers and professors, within university staff, within others, within mosques, even within mosques, that majority of them could be weak. There are individuals that resist this kind of mentality, but they are not listened to. While I agree that there is a fault within the system in actually getting its own house in order and designing a structure that develops and brings out the right people, where the committee would not be able to buy corrupt individuals, at the same time we have to put some of the blame on the others. Yeah. Both. Excuse me, brother, we have a question before.
Sorry.
Yes, sir.
I think it's a problem of the societies which these Maulanas are coming from, because in general the attitude in India and Pakistan is that those who are the failures and the dropouts tend to be Maulanas, and those who are the brightest and the most intelligent will go into
no unaccountants. I totally agree. In Iran it used to be well known whoever was running around from national service. They became Maulanas. Those who did not want to serve as soldiers for their own country, they became Maulanas. However, it has changed. It has changed to a degree in a sense that at the moment, for example, most of the well-run schools, they make a condition that you have to have at least a basic degree before you go in. But however, it's a system that has developed and evolved over the years. We can be the instigator of change, the catalyst as well. That in the same way that we tell our children constantly, how many of you, let us ask, how many of you who have children actually motivated them to go to university and then become a Maulana?
Not even 1%.
Not even one, let alone 1%. Not even one. This is the problem, that you're automatically giving higher priority to other kind of jobs rather than being a Maulana. It doesn't mean that if you were to tell your children to become a Maulana, your children is not well educated or well developed. But you don't, that's the impression you've got from this job. It's the lowest of the low. The eccentric, they go and become Maulanas when they don't have anything else to do. If that is the impression, this is what you get. You shouldn't be surprised if this is the kind of mentality you have towards the whole profession, that you get individuals that will come and re-emphasize and strengthen the same belief. Why? Because I even asked once a group of children whether they wanted to become a Maulana. Nobody replied. And when I asked why, they all said, well, we have seen our Maulana, the one who works for our community. It's nothing. If that is the future, it's not the future that I'm looking for. It says quite a lot. So what do you expect?
Well, I have a couple of very short comments and questions. One of the comments on what the brother said, I think it's true that the dropouts go to the madaris and become scholars, so-called, in India and Pakistan, but I think it's more true for the Sunnis rather than the Shia, and it has been, generally speaking. I know there are exceptions, and I know there are so-called scholars who come from sort of very low educational background, and that's all they can do. But there are so many stars and so many well-educated people who are also scholars and who sort of recite your Muharram Majalis as well. So you have examples on both sides, so it can be a bit misleading for the others who may not be aware of the situation to think that everyone is like that. Secondly, I think one has to understand the background of people in India and Pakistan compared to Iran and Iraq, for example. There is a long history of polemics, Sunni Shia polemics, that have been in India and Pakistan. People enjoy listening to this sort of stuff. I mean, you can argue that that's not a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea in all circumstances. But at the same time, the other extreme is when you try to avoid these things, especially in India and Pakistan, you can raise a generation of Shia who do not understand these things. And that is a big risk. Therefore, you find that people who come from there, and we're still in that sort of intermediate stage where, the people who've been brought up here, they're not really, they haven't taken over. So you still have that mentality coming through, and you have Maulanas who come and cater to the older generation particularly, and they like to talk about the Shia-Sunni issue, And the people, a certain top half of the people love it. So that was just a comment. The question I have, if I may sort of add it here, you're mentioning the committees and how they put imposed restrictions. And I completely take your point. The example you've given from south of the river, that's obviously a very classic example of how things should not be done. But do you not see that there are a category of people who would like to give lectures in during Muharram and so on, who have clearly views which sort of a lot of people would agree are objectionable. And therefore, if you do not have some sort of a selection, and I'm not sort of justifying all these selections, but if you say there shouldn't be any, anybody who claims to be a scholar should be invited, he should be free to say anything he likes, then don't you think that's sort of going on the other extreme? And if you agree, then you know, where is the balance? How do we balance this off?
Well, let me make a comment about the comment that you made. The problem why the lower class of people who do not possess financial means to do anything else, they somehow tend to move towards religious education, is because of the lax attitude and the cheapness of entering into these schools. They don't charge you anything. As a matter of fact, once you become a student, they feed you as well. So if we were to change our attitude towards these religious schools and make our contributions that we should make, where it would give the financial clout and the financial requirement that these centers have, or they need to organize centers that are classical, in a sense that they become, rather than just a madrasa or an education or some kind of religious establishment, they become a religious university. By that, you would be able to bridge over the two, the gap that exists, and bring the... at the moment, for example, I have questions regarding the houses that exist in London, the two houses, one which is affiliated to this center, one which is affiliated to the to Stanley. Because it is a classical kind of mentality that they have been brought up from the home and put over here, as if you were to go through the same process, but because it's in the middle of London, it would change your mentality completely. It would not. You need a structure. So that probably for the first part, we need to make more contribution and help in establishment of centers that would not be traditional, but be classical in a sense. With regard to the question of the way you presented it, I probably would ask you to elaborate a little bit further. And I will say why, because then you will see that there are different aspects within the question that we have to concentrate on. It's easy to generalize. That's something that we can do all the time. But to establish within any community, establish a center, establish an institution that understands the culture of the day, the language of the day, and the way people talk and understand each other, we cannot put it somewhere else. We cannot expect centers from Najaf, Qom, or any other place to be able to bring out or somehow develop individuals that will be capable in working in the West. Centers must be established in this country, and rather than send individuals somewhere else. I think the answer to the problem would be if we come together and work in establishing these kind of centers. Centers within our own community that we all participate and work. Then probably the issue of Shia Sunnis, whether in Pakistani community, whether one of the problems that we have, it may have existed in Pakistan and India, it may have worked over there, but the youth in this community, they are not of the same kind of mentality that they were there, or their parents were there. So they have less inhibition to actually talk to the other side. Because day in, day out, they live with them in the same school, they meet them, they play with them. We can utilize this kind of openness in addition to establishment of schools that understands the culture of the community and combine them together and then get over the problem that we have been suffering for centuries. That's probably one of the answers. But we need to analyze the situation. I have seen boys, for example, and girls that have been in living in schools that they have day in, day out come across the other faith. They are less dogmatic. And if they hear the parents talking about, oh, this is Shia, that is Sunni, as far as they are concerned, it is immaterial. They consider them brothers and sisters of the same environment. We can utilize this by bringing in addition a further catalyst, establishment of schools, religious schools in this country that understand and utilize this fact in eradication of this kind of polemical attitude that existed in Pakistan or any other society. But it requires a shift from within, that we should become broad-minded. Even, I mean, for example, the brother said about Iranians. The issue of Wilayat al-Faqih has become one of these kind of problems that we are, as soon as somebody disagrees with it, even on a theological basis, on a kind of academic basis, we brand them with being caught. We are not broad-minded enough to tolerate discontent in a sense that on an academic basis, that people have different views. Until we become more flexible, more open-minded, I don't think it's possible. This is something that they have been fed for centuries, both communities. When I have somebody standing in front of me in the middle of university holding a placard saying that you are mushrik, he or she reacts to what they have been fed. It's not easy to eradicate. It requires, the same way that it has gone over centuries, at least it requires few generations to work over.
This is more than I have in the book.
It's more polarized when it comes to Shia Sunni, but I totally agree, even between the four schools of thought. For example, the Salafis, because they are of a particular kind of mentality when it comes to what we call jurisprudential interpretation of a particular school, they consider everybody else to be kind of mushrik and munafiq. And this broad-mindedness does not exist between whether it's less of a problem between the four schools of thought than between the four schools of thought and a further one. But until we solve this problem, and on a, as I indicated earlier, on a personal basis, we start. I gave an example last night. Last year, I think it was April last year. I was invited to give a lecture in Newcastle. After the Maghrib prayer, a Pakistani brother came to me and he said, "Maulana, I'm a Shafi. Could I ask you to tell me how do you really pray? I have just done the Maghrib prayer." He said, "No, how do you really pray?" I said, "What do you mean by really? This is how I pray." He said, "No, we've been told that you pray differently. So this prayer, I can't find anything with it. But that prayer that you normally do inside your own houses or homes." He said, "No, this is exactly what we do." It suddenly clicked that for centuries, for years, they have been told constantly that the Shias probably like the Freemasons, the shake-ups or something when they do the prayer, or turn upside down, and he was under the impression that this is how we do the prayer. Now he's coming to a mosque, he thinks that I'm putting on a face to do my prayer in front of, because there are a number of Sunni brothers and sisters around. And he was asking me to actually pray the way I pray. And he wasn't convinced. The more I told him, look, exactly this is not how I pray. He said, no, I've been told that you pray differently. And this kind of problems can be resolved on a personal interaction, where the Sunni brothers and sisters come to my house and they see in close quarters the way we live. And I go into their house and I see in the close quarters the way they live. My children associate with their children associate with my children. Then we will be able to understand each other. That most of the problems that have been created for us, this illusion of animosity, doesn't exist. As a matter of fact, on some occasions I've had more faithful of a friend that they were from Sunni community than I had this from Shia community. I've been stabbed more by the Shia friends or centers than I have been stabbed by them. I haven't been stabbed by the Sunni community yet, but I've been stabbed frequently by the Shia community. I can mention a few of them. The brothers already took the message. This is the reality. What we need is to interact. Believe me, it will not be possible if we sit down here and talk for eternity and expect the politicians or the institutions or the centers or somebody else to create unity. It would not. Why? Because inherently what feeds them is that polemic. We went to Religious Park Mosque 1984. A debate. We used to have it in my MYA Baker Street. There was a problem in the center. They wanted to renovate it, and we asked permission to move to one of the small rooms downstairs in Regent's Park. One day, the Mawlana came in and sat in our lecture. A group of converts, from 1983 I've been working with them. The question was, somebody asked me a question. We know that the Holy Prophet was Ummi. He was not lettered, he was not educated. But did he become educated after the revelation of Quran through a miracle or not? So that became the question. So I went and I searched a few books, references and so on, and I came next week. And we debated it. The Regent's Park Mosque was sitting over there. He went wild. All the books that I had was there in front of him. As a matter of fact, most of them were Sunni sources, because I knew he was president. So I brought these books. He said, no. This is shirk. I said, well, where is the shirk about it? It says it in your own books. There were a couple of Egyptian brothers who became angry with the Mawlana. What happened? Next week, the door was shut, electricity was cut off. We couldn't meet in the Regent's Park Mosque. So expectation that these centers would be the source of creating unity between us is an illusion. We have to work between us. That's the only way possible. The only catalyst is on an individual basis. If the center is being fed by Saudi Arabia, or the Egyptian government, or some other governments, no matter where they are from, they would not see unity conducive to their own interests, whether we like it or whether we don't. And this is the reality. So the quicker we face it and we start working, the sooner we will achieve the unity that we want.
So I come from an Iranian background, I've been here for a long time. You look around even the Iranian mosques, the ones that speak in Persian, they start to preach mainly against what the Sunnis do, Sunnis fight against it. And that's what they've been doing for years. And they will never change that, because that's what attracts the crowd, that's what brings in the crowd to the mosque. So knowing that this is what they're going to teach you, this is what they're going to say day in, day out, what's the point of going? You might as well go to a circle.
what the point that was brought forward by the brother regarding the polemics of Shia Sunni, I totally agree that it pulls certain crowds in, not all of them. But the options that are open in front of you are two. You give up and let them carry on like this and nothing will change. Or take the bull by the horn and you instigate change by organizing a crowd of people, a number of people with you, and starting parallel programs that teaches differently. And I don't think anybody who wants to change the society will go for the first option. Because if the Sunni community goes for the first option, do you know what will happen? A friend of mine went to Shepherd Bush Mosque about 2 weeks ago. Morning prayer. He went to sujood, another brother came and put a chair over his head. Because he was Shia in a Sunni mosque. This is what will happen. If you allow the community to work on its polemic that has been fed for years, on a broad daylight, Friday mosque, 6 months ago, Finchley brought the Mawlana goes for khutbah and says the Shias are Mushrik, they have to be killed and their wives and daughters to be taken as prisoners of war. Finchley. Yes, it is. And nobody said anything. If we allow polemics to continue, this is what will happen. We will take the other part, we say they are Mushrik, they will tell us Mushrik. We never come together. The only way, the only change that could take place is when you start it. Since it doesn't exist, your responsibility doesn't evaporate. You get a group of people together and start a parallel program. Sister, no matter what they call, there is no justification. There is no justification, whoever they are, that to actually go there, to call them Mushriks, and then you can take kill them.
I know about the people who have a mosque at the beginning of the South Kensington.
No, South Kensington are these men. This is Finch, North London.
Tell me about the people who follow, who are called the Shias. They have a mosque. And those people are really
Mushrik
because they don't pray the way...
Well, I mean,
let's just... I think you were talking about that group of people.
Not necessarily. They said Shias are Mushrikeen. You can kill their men and take their women as prisoners of war. That's exactly the problem that we face. What you can do, if you were to give up, that's what happened. That is what will happen.
There are lots of lies about Shias going there, like website saying that Shias now
yes.
People and he's gone. Yeah, no, many guys and so.
There are a number of sites, but that putting the academic issue aside on a practical basis, when you are faced with this reality that whether they are Iranian centers, Arab centers, Pakistani centers, or any other center. If they are not providing, one of the problems that we have, generally speaking, with all centers, it's a kind of top-down policy rather than bottom-up. In management, there are two concepts. They say change would not take place if you were to look at it from top-down all the time. Few people get together in a corner of a mosque or in a room, they make a decision for the society. Without asking the community, without finding out what the community wants, without investigating what the services are needed within the community, and then organizing those services that are needed. They make a decision haphazardly, and then that's it. This is the center, this is the program, you have to come in. A kind of monopoly state. Unfortunately, we will become dynamic only when we search and look at the community, look at the age distribution, look at the cultural distribution, and find out what percentages each of these distributions make, and what they want, and then it's information collected from bottom, and then respond to it. The reason why you see Islamic centers in any language reacting the way they do is because of that old mentality that existed in the past. They are not prepared to change, but you can instigate it. You can move either present your ideas to the center. Either they will agree and then accommodate. Disagree, you organize parallel programs. There was another system. We have to interact. It's only through interaction. You see, the same way that we say that we should not believe whatever we read in the Western media, we should not always believe whatever we've been told by the polemic specialists. They are people who thrive and survive based on existence of division rather than convergence. Well, that's something else that I wish we could implement again.
Right. Just because from what the sister said and earlier the examples you were giving, I think it's worth just clarifying what you mean by polemics, because I've noticed that least in my discussions with people have different ideas. Now, what the brother was saying about hearing the Shia Sunni like stuff in masajid, it can mean two different things, at least to me. One is what I call polemics, which is unnecessary sort of, lighting fire sort of stuff, which is not, you're not imparting knowledge, you're not explaining the facts. You're just enjoying sort of, throwing hints, disparaging people and rousing emotions and so on. So that is the bit that is unnecessary and it causes damage. But at the same time, I think there's a risk that if people react to it without thinking, they can go to the other extreme and say, oh, we don't want to talk about any differences between the Shia and the Sunni. And we will then be even more susceptible, especially the younger generation that's growing up here, of going to a mosque, so going to sujood and seeing the Shia and wondering what's going on. At least now we know what's going on, because we have that sort of common knowledge, and we need to be able to come together and actually learn why these people have been brainwashed. What is the logic that's being fed into them? And how we need to have answers for them. But some people will look at that as polemics as well. I think it's the method by which you actually understand these things.
Yeah, what I meant by it was the first definition, primarily only swearing against each other and cursing and so on, and spreading nothing but hatred. As far as the second one being classified as polemic, it is possible for some people to define it that way. But even if there are shortcomings within the youth and community of our society, the fault lies within us, as parents, as scholars, as religious individuals, that we have not discharged our responsibility fully the way they should. Otherwise, once they reach the age of 20 or 18, between 18 and end of their teens and beginning of 20 and 21, they should not be in ignorance as far as their basic beliefs are concerned, let alone some other things. But again, going to the point that the brother mentioned, I totally agree with the problem that we are facing a number of problems with traditional centers, no matter what language, whether Iranians, Arabs, Pakistanis or something. And we need to reorganize ourselves. And even the elders require education, that they are living in a different world, in a different environment, in a different culture, and we require a different attitude towards them. And if they are not prepared to adjust and somehow educate themselves, it's better for them to stand aside for a younger generation to come in where they will be able to work better.
I lived in the early 80s in America, and it was actually the heat of the polemics between Shia and Sunni, especially in mosques of students at university. And we were given options, either You
didn't say this because I'm here. I have to lay the floor to somebody else.
That's a very good idea. I'm learning from the crowd.
You can add it to the list.
Yes, from the motor.
Thank you, Rana. I was going to say that we were given the option either to immerse ourselves into more qualities and therefore more high things with each other, each one creating some problems, or to be given another choice, which was to create some kind of workshops. We start with the Indonesia community, which we start doing with ourselves, how to deal with others, in which we became a practice within ourselves, which is good for us in the meantime, you know, how to be humble to each other, how not to curse others, how not to, you know, to deal with them in a nice way and so on. And it worked very well, I must say, that was a very successful thing.
And that supports the idea that you would not be expecting from a traditional center to organize these kinds of things. In either communities, whether the Sunnis or the Shias, it is change will take place when, if you don't like what you see and you want to improve it, you organize it. Rather than sit back and say, oh, well, this is a center that has not provided anything or does not care about our needs. It is possible you take the first step and things will happen.
You have to say 10 mosques, 10 Shia mosques, you know, just for example. And there's Ashura, Zion Ashura, and all of them will have an Ashura program. And all of them will show like one quarter full, the rest empty. And to do this, you have to think, what you have to know about the culture of Ashura and things like that. There's no thing you actually need to know anything about Ahkam or any other thing associated with Islam. And they think that way. They want to come to that Ashura program every year, all of them. And no one cares anything or even any energy into teaching all the other aspects of Islam. So just grow ignorant of everything else. And you just know about Ashura and all the...
Yeah. It's part of the overall problem of organization within most religious centers. But remember, brother, that these religious centers can be classified as traditional religious centers. They may be existing in London, but the organizational model behind it is copied from somewhere else. It's not a new organizational model. And hence, you don't expect them to change, to be different. There are two possibilities. You either propose change yourself, and then they would organize it, or you organize change somewhere else.
Do you have an example of a change?
I mean, for example, with regard to Ashura, since it's been mentioned a couple of times, to make Ashura, presented outside the traditional way, workshops is one. Question and answer, rather than let, say, Mawlana coming and delivering some kind of speeches, question and answers, debates, discussion, parallel somewhere else. And you organize the full program that not only the history can be debated and discussed, other issues within Ashura itself, ahkam, religion, ideas, Islamic identity, and other things can be discussed as well. When I was doing my MBA, we had a lecture on marketing. He said the expectation that the marketing method that has worked successfully for a particular company would work for another company equally well is like somebody who lights a match to lit a cigarette and then uses the same match again somewhere else on the expectation that it worked once. We have even a marketing policy that has worked for a particular company has to be modified to fit somewhere else. Ashura in a style of presentation might have worked back home, wherever this back home might be. But we have to change it. Because people react emotionally to things differently in this country than somewhere else. That by itself would justify a new approach, a new look. And once we have searched and analyzed different methods, we will be able to come to a conclusion which method fits our own need and the environment that we live in.
Elena, going through the history, what I have come to know that due to lack of Quranic knowledge, we have suffered quite a lot. Because in Quran it says that we should not abuse anybody, either it is anybody from Ahlus Sunnah or from Shia or from... Now, if we have primary Quranic education, that Arabic, then that thing would have been in our minds. But since we left that thing, we left the knowledge of Quran, mostly I think, you know, this is the repercussion of that thing.
Well, there are a number of issues, but I think I go back to the point. The problem is that Islam, the spirit of Islam has been has evaporated, and we are left with superficial issues. In the wasiyah or the advice given by Amir al-Mu'mineen to Imam Hassan just before his death, he says, Allah, Allah, the Quran. Be aware that the day will come when the spirit of Quran is acted upon by somebody else, you will be left with only the papers or the book itself in your hand. And then in reality, what we have today, the spirit of Quran, which is the spirit of Islam, disappeared. And when you look and analyze Islam, there are a number of proclamations by the Holy Prophet regarding education. It doesn't exist. We discriminate between individuals within our own community. Unity. There are a number of verses in the Holy Quran based on unity and presented on different ways. It doesn't exist. Belief and faith in Islam, and believe that Islam would solve the problem. It doesn't exist. The concept of leadership, Allah, Allah, and then again, beginning of it says, Tinnaduma Amrakum, organizing structure within the community, and leadership. It doesn't exist. Following advice, if you don't like the advice, you kill the messenger, rather than change yourself. Self-sacrifice, that's the last thing we do in our own community. How many of us are prepared to put Islam and the interest of Islam before our own interests? We don't. Broad-mindedness, we've been talking about this. Clear understanding of our religion, whether it is ahkam, whether it's other issues of religion. Even those who spend little bit of time analyzing religion, we pick little bit, just pieces here and there. Confronting injustice. If it's done within our own community, we are not prepared to say anything against it. But if somebody else does it, we are the one that jumps out trying to criticize. Disciplines, valuing towns, etc. These are the problems. This is the spirit of Islam that somebody else values. We are left with superficial issues. Quran is one of them, others, Sunnah is the other one. Etiquette and social etiquettes of behaviors. Quran says, with regard even to Ahlul Kitab, تَعَالُوا إِلَىٰ كَلِمَةٍ سَوَاءٍ بَيْنَنَا وَبَيْنَكُمْ أَنْ لَا نَعْبُدُ إِلَّا اللَّهُ. That even on this commonality, that the belief on the unity of God could be the point of convergence that we can debate and come together. Even based on this little idea, we can work together. We are not prepared to understand and work, is the point. We destroy each other, character, they assassinate each other. And this, what do we expect? We expect miracle that suddenly with all these that are not there, our society to evolve, to be the best. كُنْتُمْ خَيْرُ أُمَّةٍ أُخْرِجَتْ لِلنَّاسِ. In the past tense, you were the one, or you will become the one. But based on conditions. As long as you don't satisfy conditions, God is not going to give you honor and dignity. If you search honor, إِنَّ لِلَّهَ الْعِزَّةُ وَلَرَسُولِهِ. Honor and dignity lives in the belief of Allah and application of the command, of His command. If you search honor somewhere else, you'll be left to yourself. Thank you very much, brothers and sisters. Inshallah, we'll organize something next week.
Assalamu alaikum.